Est-ce que vous avez vu des autres, des camarades avec des singes ou des ours? Stray Gypsy, A.D. 1912. That was the top of the walk when he said, have you seen any others, any of our lot, with apes or bears? A brown, upstanding fellow, not like the half-castes, up on the wet road near Clermont. The wind came and the rain, and mist clotted about the trees in the valley, and I had the long ways behind me, Grey Arl and Beaucaire, and he said, seen any of our lot? I'd seen a lot of his lot ever since Rodez coming down from the fair St. John with caravans, but never an ape or a bear.
That's modernist giant Ezra Pound reading his poem, The Gypsy. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Ezra Pound was born in Idaho in 1885, but by the time he died in 1972, he had been accused of treason and had lived for most of his adult life in Europe, writing poetry and encouraging the work of other modernist poets. What were Pound's most important contributions? Why did he become a fascist? Joining us to explore the life and work of Ezra Pound is Serena Pondrum, professor of English at the UW-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
It's been a long time. When I look at those dates for Ezra Pound and the places, not just Idaho, but the Idaho Territory in 1885, and then living until 1972 when he was living mostly in Italy, a whole world of history and geography open up that this man must have covered one way or the other.
You know, in many respects, I think Pound emblemizes both the remarkable creativity and the remarkable tragedy of the 20th century. In some important senses, his life represents both of those things. But you speak of Haley, Idaho. What people may not realize is that his father's family was involved in state government in the state of Wisconsin.
Yes, you see, mm-hmm. He was the grandson of the lieutenant governor.
That's exactly true. And he was born in Haley, Idaho, but the family didn't stay there very long. And they moved back to Pennsylvania, to a permanent home in Wincote, Pennsylvania, in 1892. And Pound's father took a position with the U.S. Mint, an increasingly responsible position with the U.S. Mint. And I've sometimes reflected that Pound's obsession with credit and his fascination in the teens with C.H. Douglas's social credit theory may well have some deep-rooted sources of what one can only imagine is the symbolism of seeing all of those coins minted.
Philadelphia Mint.
In the Philadelphia Mint. Money became an emblem of some very important things that he saw as wrong with the government of the United States. And some of those concerns actually lay behind the tragic later years when he did move to Italy and support Mussolini.
All that argument about the gold standard and William Jennings Bryan and all that as Pound was coming of age.
Exactly. But he had a very different course in his youth. He entered the University of Pennsylvania, where he became acquainted with two other of the major modernist poets, the poet H.D., whose father was director of the Flower Observatory at the University of Pennsylvania.
And that's just H period, D period.
Yeah, Hilda Doolittle, but she goes by the initials, H.D., and William Carlos Williams, who took his medical degree at the University of Pennsylvania during the same years that Pound was enrolled there studying Romance languages. And brought into their circle eventually was Marianne Moore, who was in Bryn Mawr at the same time that H.D. attended Bryn Mawr. So there was a remarkable coincidence, a serendipity probably, of the coming together of these very gifted people, already understanding by the time of those college years that they intended to be poets and experimenting with new poetry. Clearly, they fed on each other's creativity and experiment.
In Pound, there's always this sort of anti-conventional, sort of trying to find a way to break rules, it seems to me. And I get the feeling that started early in college.
It started very early. In fact, H.D.'s father wasn't very pleased with the fact that a semi-engagement had resulted between H.D. and Pound. He had quite bright red hair, and he affected a cape that he wore, looking stereotypically poetic. and not, I think, bringing any reassurance to Professor Doolittle that his daughter would be in good hands. And Pound had his escapades at that time. He went off to teach at a very conservative college in Wabash, Indiana. And he granted a woman that he met on the streets the opportunity to spend the night in his rooms, where she was found the next morning by the landlady, and no protestations of Pound's part, his concern for the homeless, prevented her from ejecting him forthwith, and Wabash College dismissed him in mid-semester. He was paid off for the rest of the semester, and he took the money, and he traveled then to Venice. And that began the long years of exile that Pound was to spend in Europe. He wasn't in Venice terribly long. He moved almost immediately to London. And it was here in London that he began some of the early poems that he came to talk about in his essay on vorticism as the poems in which he adopted a persona of another figure and cast it off in the course of writing successive poems. Now, one thing that's important about this is that the early 20th century was very interested in what the subject was, who the self was. And this development of the construction of a persona and then the substitution of other personas in his very early poetry characterizes one of the ways in which Pound connects with these very important themes in the 20th century.
When you say constructs a persona, you don't mean something like to his last Duchess, like, you know, a Browning poem where we're clearly hearing the voice of an historical figure or a pseudo-historical figure.
When Pound began, he was very close to Browning. This process underwent mutation as he began to express facets of his own personality as well. One of the poems that is perhaps notable in illustrating this is a rather early poem in his collection called Chino, which came out in that early collection that he published in London in 1908 called Adume Spento.
What does the title Chino mean?
And Chino is the first name of one of the Provençal poets that Pound studied as a student of Romance languages. Eventually, he came to know some 13 different languages, and tags of many of them show up in his poems.
I know. That's why you need footnotes for Pound.
Well, it may very well be that the presence of foreign quotations in his poems have much the same status that he saw them having in the wasteland.
T.S. Eliot, famous or notorious for that. It's the kind of thing that Mark Twain complained about, you know, when he put little hieroglyphics as epigrams before chapters of his books.
And
who can read this?
Speaking of the wasteland, Pound maintained that it really didn't make any difference whether you identified what the source of the quotation was or not, that the power of the images, the meaning of the words, would establish the emotion, which was important for the poem, without respect to whether or not you gave it an academic reading. I suspect many of his own poems are the same kind.
So this is Chino,
This is Chino, and I will just read the first two stanzas of what is, in fact, a couple-of-page poem. Bah! I have sung women in three cities, but it is all the same, and I will sing of the sun. Lips, words, and you snare them. Dreams, words, and they are as jewels, strange spells of old deity. Ravens, knights, allurement, and they are not, having become the souls of song. Now that poem goes on to project the figure of Chino the troubadour as a figure denied economic stability, a vagabond traveling from city to city entertaining.
Sounds a little like Mr. Pound to me so far.
And in some respects, Chino emblemizes the difficult position of the modernist artist in the beginning of the 20th century when so many people read, but very few people read poems of the sort that Pound wrote. And as the world changed around him and it became less and less easy for a poet to make his own way just writing poetry, Pound repeatedly expressed nostalgia for a society in which patrons preserve the opportunity for the poet to write and to perform. And this poem exemplifies this in important ways. But it also exemplifies the early Pound's notion of the way in which he transforms beauty into art. Now, he was going to move away from these quasi-romantic attitudes and these connections that were, as you suggest in a comment just a moment ago, close to Browning, when this was 1908, within the next 4 years, he moved into what we know as his Imagist period. And together with H.D. and several other figures in England at that time, initiated a movement in modern poetry which really became a characteristic of the way language was used in modern poetry in the first, 25 years, really, of the century.
One of the most famous Imagist poems that I think he wrote is the one that shows up in every anthology and has just a couple of lines, the In a Station in a Metro. Can you read that and talk about why it's always held up there as such a good example of an Imagist poem?
There were actually two versions of In a Station in the Metro. The first one was characteristic of early experiment in which it was actually spaced out on the page in a way that imitated the kinds of pauses that he wanted. But in the current collection of his early poems, that has gone by the wayside. The poem in its entirety, and you cannot ignore the title, is In a Station of the Metro. The apparition of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet black bough. Now, that's a poem of superimposed images in which the entire speech is made by the image.
Give us that again.
The apparition of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet black bough. Now, we know a lot of things as a result of that poem. The location, obviously, is a metro station in Paris. Underground, it is a location of almost claustrophobic urban press of moving people. The people are not perceived as whole persons, but objectified and dehumanized by the fact that they appear simply as faces. And in fact, the extent to which their dehumanization in this environment is complete is suggested by the very word apparition. It is as if they are ghostly shapes.
Not quite real.
Almost unreal. And yet, he focuses on these individual faces. One suspects the perspective is of a metro train stopping very briefly in a station as he looks through the window at the faces that coalesce and then dissolve before him. And he sees that in this setting of anomie, this setting of urban crush in which individuality seems lost, there is nonetheless a transient but haunting beauty, petals on a wet black bough. And the petals on a wet black bough really conjure an image of Japanese painting of the time, just as the poem conjures the image of a Japanese haiku poem of the time, in which there was an element of extraordinary beauty at the same time that he recognized some of the ways in which the urban environment was dehumanizing. This is accomplished completely by what is effectively a single equation. Faces, petals. It is really a two-image poem superimposed, and in that montage, in that superposition, he makes a statement about the experience of living in modern Paris that could take you several pages to expo.
It's sort of like an uncompromised metaphor in a way. I mean,
yes.
or you know, even a simile, instead of saying it's like this, that, or the other, and going on for a stanza or two, he's simply jamming those two images together.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, I suggested earlier that one of the philosophical issues at the beginning of the 20th century was the question of who the self was, what the subject was. One of the other major issues was the question of how we know. How do we know what we know, and what is the authority behind our knowing what we know? Now, you had figures like William James, who in the 1890s had written The Principles of Psychology, and had pointed out that there's a continuous flow through the consciousness, and the reality of the individual derives from his singling out specific details in that flow and constructing the real from the details that he selects from that endless and essentially infinite flow through consciousness. Henri Bergson, who was in Paris at about the same time that Pound was writing this, was saying something somewhat similar. And the issue here then became, well, suppose then we don't really know what we know. We don't have an absolute knowledge of reality. But in fact, I have my reality and you have your reality. And how do we communicate with each other if that's true? How do we manage through the medium of language to know each other? Well, one of the things that the imagists were concerned to do was to reduce the poem to nothing but the barest images, put those images out there for the reader to grasp and believe, which we might not believe today, but believe that the associations that the reader would have with those images would recreate in the mind of the reader the same emotion, the same understanding that the poet sought to communicate.
It certainly worked that way for me, but I wonder if you had run William Carlos Williams or Wallace Stevens or any a number of other poets through that same Paris Metro, what they would have seen, what their reality would have been.
I think you would find that particularly in the years immediately after this, that you would see William Carlos Williams using some of these very same strategies. He has a poem called El Hombre, in which he says, "It's a strange courage you give me, distant star, shining alone in the sunset to which you contribute nothing."
And he has the one about so much depends on a red wheelbarrow.
So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow. Glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens.
And that's it. That's the whole poem. And that's very reminiscent of this one.
Yes, exactly so. So, I mean, the philosophers, poets, linguists, this was a period of Saussure as well, and then soon of Wittgenstein, were all very much concerned with the fact that knowledge was not absolute. The window we look through at the world isn't transparent.
I can see where eventually he would have gotten interested in Eastern religion.
And in fact did, thinking, yes, yeah. as did Eliot.
I was kind of intrigued also, as sort of an aside, I suppose, but you mentioned a minute ago, Serena, the placement of the words on the page to indicate mm-hmm. how the poem should be interpreted, which is a wonderful a way of linking words and music. You just start to get a sense of how you're supposed to read this. But E.E. Cummings, I think, did a little bit of that too, did he not?
Well, he went even further. E.E. Cummings was an artist. I mean, he was genuinely an artist. In fact, he was better known as an artist than he was as a poet at some periods of his life.
A graphic artist, you mean?
Yes, visual painter, mm-hmm. a watercolorist. And there are even with Cummings poems in which the content of the poem is actually represented by the shape of the poem on the page.
Which is an old, I mean, that was tinkered with sort of a whimsical way back in the 17th, 18th century, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It has a long heritage. And in fact, at about this same time, Apollinaire in the collection called Caligram was doing that to an even greater extreme. But yes, Cummings actually represented on the page a lot of this was also a very good-humored construction of the poem as well.
Well, what about Pound in music? Because when the clip we heard of him reading one of his own poems, he reads in sort of a sing-song, almost singing voice. A lot of the titles of his poems, like Cantos and others, seem to come from music. What did he think of the relationship between poetry and
Pound
music?
Pound actually was, at some level, a musician. As you probably know, one of the Peace and Cantos is nothing but several bars of music. Olga, the mother of his daughter Mary, was a concert violinist. And Pound had some elaborate theories of the great bass in which he discussed the significance of music and poetry and music as a means of communication. So, yes, he was very much associated. He was particularly associated with the experimental music of George Antheil.
The bad boy of American music.
The bad boy of American music, right, who introduced into the musical score fire engine whistles, bells, and wrote some very interesting music at the same time, I might add.
Great autobiography, too.
Yes. There's another poem that might perhaps be of interest with respect to this Imagist period, which, interestingly, Pound takes from his so-called Chinese period, which came about 3 or 4 years after the Imagist period. But it is one in which the poet tells you himself how to read his poetry, a rare find. It's called The Jewel Stairs Grievance. The jewel steps are already quite white with dew. It is so late that the dew soaks my gauze stockings. And I let down the crystal curtain and watch the moon through the clear autumn. Now, this is one of his reworkings of the poetry of Li Po via a Japanese translation which had been conveyed to him by Ernest Fenollosa. Pound offers a commentary on this poem. Note, jewel stairs, therefore a palace. Grievance, therefore there is something to complain of. Gauze stockings, therefore a court lady, not a servant who complains. Clear autumn, therefore he has no excuse on account of weather. Also, she has come early, for the dew has not merely whitened the stair, but has soaked her stockings. The poem is especially prized because she utters no direct reproach. Though it is a reading of a Chinese poem that he has rendered in English, it could, in fact, be a roadmap to reading the poems of Pound's Imagist period.
We're going to look more at the poetry of Ezra Pound when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I resolved that at 30 I would know more about poetry than any man living, that I would know the dynamic content from the shell, what part of poetry was indestructible, what part could not be lost by translation, what effects were attainable in one language only and were utterly incapable of being translated. In this search, I learned more or less 9 foreign languages. That's the comments of Ezra Pound in 1907. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Serena Pondrum, and we are talking about the giant of modernist poetry, Ezra Pound, a very controversial and problematic figure in many ways. Tell us about his growing interest in the form of poetry.
This is one of the most important elements of Pound's contribution to modernism. He articulated it in a particularly clear form in an essay in 1914 called Vorticism. And he sought to differentiate vorticism from the imagism, which had gone before.
Now, vortex like the whirlpool?
Vortex like the whirlpool, exactly mm-hmm. So. By saying vorticism is an intensive art. I mean by this that one is concerned with the relative intensity or relative significance of different forms of expression. One desires the most intense, for certain forms of expression are more intense than others. They are more dynamic. Now, having set a goal of the intensity of the text, he goes on to talk about poetic form using the analogy of mathematics. And he identifies 4 different categories of mathematics. First of all, of course, simple addition and subtraction, the arithmetical, then the algebraic, then the geometric. And then he finally comes to Descartian, or analytic geometry. And he says space is conceived as separated by two or three axes. One refers points to these axes by a series of coordinates. Given the idiom, one is able actually to create. Then he goes on to give the example of the circle and the equation for the circle. It's not a particular circle. It is any circle and all circles. It is the circle free of space and time limits. It is the universal, existing in perfection, in freedom from space and time. In analytics, we come upon a new way of dealing with form. It is in this way that art handles life. And he goes on to illustrate. The statements of analytics are lords over fact. They are the thrones and dominations that rule over form and recurrence. And in like manner are great works of art, lords over fact, over race-long recurrent moods, and over tomorrow. Great works of art contain this fourth sort of equation. They cause form to come into being.
I followed everything except maybe the last statement, they cause form to come into being. I can see where a great work of art would transcend, you know, time and place and be sort of an ideal thing in its own right. But other than a kind of a flat literal interpretation saying, well, if you write something with a certain stanza structure or some other kind of form to it that would then be applied to other poetry, what does he mean by that?
Well, let me use the analogy of a number of points that appear on a surface before you. If you can think of it as a three-dimensional surface, it would be even more useful. The various images and narratives in the poem represents a kind of point in this structure. You connect these points, and as you read, you don't necessarily connect them in any fixed order. And furthermore, there's more than one way to connect the points. And yet, as you bring them together, you bring the form of that poem into being.
Oh, it's your own interpretation. It's your own form that you're creating from this, whatever you want to call it, template that he's giving
you. Each reader recreates the poem from the materials that the poem presents. And from this characteristic come some of the distinctive hallmarks of the long, fragmented, paratactic poems of the 20th century. Listen to what he says about what happens. The image is not an idea. It is a radiant node or cluster. It is what I can and must perforce call a vortex, from which and through which and into which ideas are constantly rushing. Now, when you take the paratactic forms of the cantos, or a poem that may be more familiar to most people of, let us say, The Wasteland, you recognize the dynamism of that poetic form because of the multiplicity of patterns that you can make within the structure of the poem. Yet the poem continues to control the possibilities within which that structure is put together. But it is these relationships among things that are crucial in the interpretation of experience, the modernist poet argued. Pound quoted Aristotle in one of his theoretical texts, relations are more important than the things related.
It reminds me a little bit of what James Joyce is quoted as saying in a kind of a whimsical way, that there are so many associations with each of the key words in his text that the English teachers would be occupied for generations with the various permutations of them.
And that brings me to my question. Did he see his audience then as a sort of intellectual elite? I mean, did Pound have any interest in reaching sort of, you know, the common people? Because it seems to me with his foreign quotations and his fairly elaborate theories that he is an elitist in some ways.
I think that depends upon how you interpret the reader that he wants to reach. He was very much concerned to enlist people in understanding the stakes in art, the ideas about the construction of the subject, about the forces which drive human experience. And he regarded communicating that understanding of the nature of reality, extraordinarily significant for everyone, absolutely for the common man. His distaste for capitalism came very much from his sense of the exploitation of the common man along with the artist. So, yes, he sought to reach a public that he regarded as potentially benefited by what it is that he had to say.
I was thinking how different he is from Robert Frost, and I know he encouraged Frost in his publication, but they seem so different if you think of Stopping by the Woods on a Snowy Evening or, you know, it's such a different voice and a different approach to what a poem can be.
Well, I think I would separate the early poems, the ones we've talked about right now, which I have always found are immediately accessible to a group of students who reacts to the images. If they come to the poem with some preconceived notion of how to impose meaning on it, that's another matter. But they'll just simply sit back, trust themselves, react to the images, and then answer for themselves the question, what does the combination of those images add up to? Where does it point? They are on target 99% of the time. So I don't really think it is difficult to read the early Pound. Now, when you begin to get into the cantos and you get very long poems, very paratactic in nature, I think it is legitimate to say that these are very challenging poems, and they are poems in which it is likely that the reader will understand only a fragment of the poems until they have read them a number of times. There is something of that dynamic throughout modernism, however. The second phase of modernism was a phase in which, instead of just using the concrete image, the poet was consistently trying to speak for a larger community, was often speaking in a much longer and often mythically informed text, which there was a great deal of parataxis and discontinuity, which reflected his perception of the modern world, but did not make reading easier.
It does remind me of a lot of paintings of the time.
Yes, absolutely.
Very disjointed, and you look at the pattern and interpret as you will.
Absolutely, and as with the painters, the poets felt that they were pointing to a higher reality, to a more accurate rendering of experience than a simple conventional representative painting would be.
I'm back a couple of miles here, Serena, in a sense, because I'm trying to figure out what the transition from imagism to vorticism is and exactly how the one plays off the other.
You know, they're very closely related. The concept of moving form, of the dynamism of form, is one of the main things which differentiates the theoretical statements that Pound made about the images period and the vortices period. And this is especially true if you understand that the image is not necessarily a single word. It may be an event. It may be a narrative unit as well as being a single image. When you recognize that, and then you imagine these elements arranged together without the intrusion of the poet saying, you should relate them this way. As soon as you recognize that, you recognize the enormous dynamism, the volatility, the multivocality of the poem in that pattern. That's your real difference conceptually between imagism and vorticism.
And is there a poem that you can give us, a piece of a poem that would illustrate sort of the vorticist poem? If you see the In the Station in the Metro and the Petals on the Black Bough as an imagist poem, is there a passage that shows what Pound had in mind?
In the interests of time, I'll need to quote a pretty brief one, but yes. Blue mountains to the north of the walls, white river winding about them. Here we must make separation and go out through 1,000 miles of dead grass. Mind like a floating wide cloud. Sunset like the parting of old acquaintances who bow over their clasped hands at a distance. Our horses neigh to each other as we are departing. Now the vortex of that poem comes in the intersection between the comprehension of the infinity of the natural world and historical time, the blue mountains, the white river winding about them, the 1,000 miles of dead grass. And then violently intersecting with this image of a kind of eternity is the poignance of a personal affection now being rent apart, intensified by the fact that the men say nothing. It is the horses that neigh.
Interesting point. Are we led to make a deduction about that regarding the communication there coming from the horses and not from the friends?
Oh, absolutely. The impossibility of articulating in language, the complexity of the emotion that is rendered here in this collision of planes, in this vortex of transition from being together to being apart.
Would you read that again?
Blue mountains to the north of the walls, White River winding about them. Here we must make separation and go out through 1,000 miles of dead grass. Mind like a floating wide cloud. Sunset like the parting of old acquaintances who bow over their clasped hands at a distance. Our horses neigh to each other as we are departing. This is the kind of sunset of a relationship, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The poignancy is rooted in the expectation that these two figures, who are almost certainly warriors on the outer wall of the Chinese Empire at that time, very unlikely to see each other again. This was very likely to be a permanent pointing.
It does come certainly across as a Chinese landscape.
Right,
from
it
the
does.
Beginning.
I think the image of vorticism really becomes especially interesting when we extend it to the cantos, because it is necessary, I think, to draw upon that idea of the way in which a poem instantiates relationships, establishes connections, identifies patterns in human experience which recur, but which you infer from the narrative and symbolic material of the poem, that you particularly see why vorticism is useful in conceptualizing the cantos.
I just think it would be much more difficult if you're talking about a vast poetic canvas in these cantos that he worked on, what, from 1915 to 1970 or something like that. There would be so many of these points to connect that you would have a vast universe of places you could either misstep or you know, diverge from everyone else.
Well, absolutely. But I would back away from trying to establish a single determinant meaning for the cantos. Part of the dynamism, part of the vortex of the cantos is the multiplicity of the ways in which it means.
Right. Again, it's like it's looking at a dynamic, flowing, living
exactly.
thing.
And Pound was trying to create something which captured the complexity of human experience. He didn't want something that was reductively simple.
Let me ask you a mundane question then about the cantos and all of their complexity and what would be the word subjectivity. How does anybody who writes about the cantos have any kind of authority?
I mean, well, I think that's a legitimate question about any critic.
Well, that's true,
the
some more than others.
The authority that I have is as a sensitive reader, and I don't articulate a determinate meaning of a poem that the next reader is obliged to replicate.
You can't say Pound means this or that as we move from this image to the next.
I can say Pound means this or that to me.
And what effect did World War I have on Pound? I know we're going to get into a little bit of a discussion of World War II and his interest in Mussolini.
Well, World War I ruptured the enormously creative period in 1912, 13, and 14 in London. And this was a period of efflorescence of poetry. And it was a period in which Pound was really cock of the walk in London in circles of experimental poetry. Then all the men marched off to war, friends of Pound slain. Gaudiar Zhirska, the painter, killed in the war. The Vorticism essay is in a collection that was established in memoriam for Gaudiar Zhirska. Hume, Lewis, all affected. One killed, the other damaged psychologically, I think it would be fair to say, by the war. And the possibility of keeping this kind of experimental dynamism together in London vanished. By 1920, Pound was ready to leave, and the poem that he wrote as the farewell to London was the Hugh Selwyn Moberly, in which he offers you two different artists, both failures, the EP figure and the Moberly figure, each of which tried in his own way to carry out an Imagist program, and neither of which succeeded in being genuinely successful. So after he published Hugh Selwyn Moberly, he left for Paris. And then from Paris, he migrated on down to Italy.
And we'll follow him to Italy for a woefully few minutes when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest, Serena Pondrum. Our topic, the controversial, the fascinating, enigmatic even, Ezra Pound, whose masterwork is, you could almost say, his lifetime work. We have referred to a few times already the Cantos, which occupied him for a good 50 years, if not longer. What makes the Cantos, other than their sheer scope, different from what he had done before?
The Cantos seek to incorporate in their 116 different cantos the whole of human experience, the entire periplum, if you will, the horizon of human experience. And Pound does that by drawing on blocks of material which he weaves together. One of those is certainly myth. And we see, for example, in Canto 1, the figure of the poet as Odysseus launched and then went down to the ship, set keel to breakers, forth on the godly sea, and we set up mast and sail on that swart ship, bore sheep aboard her and our bodies also, heavy with weeping, and winds from sternward bore us out, onward, with bellying canvas. Circe's, this craft, the trim-coiffed goddess. With those lines, taken very directly from Odyssey, Canto 11, Pound sets the quest of the poet and the quest of the human being to win home, to get back to Ithaca. And mimes in this opening canto his harrowing of hell, for he proceeds in this canto down to ask of Tiresias, what must I do to get home? And the formulation of the question, what is it that mankind must do to reach an appropriate goal, to get back to what the fundamental meaning of his experience is? To reach his Penelope, if you will.
So this is Pound's Odyssey,
this is Pound's
series
Odyssey.
Of poems.
It is. But in addition to those kinds of mythic materials which he weaves together, he is very much concerned in the cantos with what is the nature of action in history. What does action in history mean? What is the hero? What does it mean to be a hero? And obviously Odysseus is an example, but he uses countless other kinds of figures. Sigismundo Malatesta, who was a figure from the years of the formation of the Italian state, who was not only a warrior but also one who built the Tempio, who built the location in which the arts could be performed and protected. Mussolini was an example of that. John Adams and Thomas Jefferson were examples of that. And there
interesting are, company.
There are many cantos that incorporate directly the letters and texts of Adams and Jefferson.
Did Pound think of himself still as an American?
Oh, yes, absolutely so. In fact, in 1939, his last return to the United States before he was brought back after his capture in Pisa, he was trying to get the United States to do what he thought they ought to do in World War II. And he expected to be received by the senators he sought to talk to. He had every conviction that he was saying something they needed to hear and was extraordinarily dismayed when he had no opportunity to talk with the people that he
sought. He was maybe a little out of touch with the thinking in America?
Completely, at that point. He had been increasingly isolated in Italy.
And with all the foreign quotations, the Chinese characters, the various things that find their way into the cantos, was he trying to write a sort of global
epic? Yes, indeed. Oh, absolutely so. The notion of literature as global is not just a recent discovery. Mm-hmm. Pound was eminently concerned to try to articulate patterns and experience which were shared cross-culturally. He drew on myth from Africa as well as myth from Greece and Rome. He drew on the sayings of Confucius as well as any Western religious motifs. And he was very much concerned about what the nature of the currents are which threaten right action. If he wanted to identify what constitutes right action in history, he was also very concerned to establish what made it hazardous. And I guess if you wanted to be really reductive, you could reduce that to maybe five different things, three of them very closely related. Love, sex, and vision, almost syncretically connected, greed, and indifference. And in the passage from the cantos that I read, you will remember the line, "Circe's this craft." The figure of the seductive female could be alternatively in Pound's understanding of experience, something that spurred the poet and the human being to vision, and that which spurred the human being to violent action or to hubris.
Well, I mean, it's the oldest cutting edge in the world, isn't it? Between,
absolutely,
you know, women bring out the best, they bring out the worst,
absolutely,
in a man.
Absolutely. These kinds of very basic patterns were the patterns that he explored, and he tried to do so in multiple cultures. So he took the experience of Jefferson and Adams. He took the experience of Sigismund of Malatesta. His second canto is drawing upon the works of Browning, founded also on the troubadour Sordello.
Well, how would someone who seemed so cosmopolitan, so global, so inclusive in many ways, how would he then justify his allegiance to fascism, which seems so destructive of difference, and also his anti-Semitism?
Well, I think the Italian period has to be understood in part as a period in which Pound became increasingly psychotic. He was very isolated in Italy and carried with him to Italy a fascination with C.H. Douglas's social credit theory, which he saw as very similar to the kind of communal structure that Mussolini supported. Pound was never attracted to Hitler and never had any association with German fascism. His association was with Mussolini, whom he saw as speaking on behalf of the peasant over against the syndicate, over against the kinds of predations of a capitalist world. Now, there is no question that his assessment in this period became increasingly misguided and increasingly volcanic. And he broadcast over Rome radio tirades expressing his point of view. Never, I might add, the kinds of broadcasts that urged American troops to defect. It was political speech. But in the context of war, political speech on behalf of the enemy was not acceptable. And so he was, in fact, arrested immediately after American troops landed in Italy. He was taken to Pisa, which was a common concentration camp for the retention of prisoners, some who had committed murder, some who had defected, some who had caused predations to a population rather than a legitimate enemy. And he was confined in the yard of Pisa in a tin box without a roof for almost 2 weeks in the sun, in the summer, until, in fact, he had a nervous breakdown. And one of the medical officers at Pisa moved him into a barracks, gave him a typewriter, a battered typewriter. He had no books except two anthologies he found in the latrine. And a soldier, an African-American soldier there, scoured up a packing box for him to use as a desk. And it was at this location that he wrote the Peace and Cantos, which are usually thought of as the absolute epitome of his accomplishment in the cantos. At this point, he had significantly reconceived the political attitudes and the personal behavior which he had engaged in over the last decade. And the Peace and Cantos contain, it is, I think, perhaps for that reason that they speak so poignantly to the tragedy of the 20th century. They contain his reassessment of that world. And I would like to quote several lines from Canto 81. "What thou lovest well remains. The rest is dross. What thou lovest well shall not be reft from thee. What thou lovest well is thy true heritage. Whose world? Or mine? Or theirs? Or is it of none? The ant's a centaur in his dragon world. Pull down thy vanity. It is not man made courage, or made order, or made grace. Pull down thy vanity, I say. Pull down. Learn of the green world what can be thy place in scaled invention or true artistry. Pull down thy vanity. Peck can pull down."
And is there one line that we can end this Pound hour with that you think sums him up?
Pound continued to write poems after Pisa, but he never regained the confidence in the articulation of a universal pattern. And I think the fragment of Canto 116, which is the last of the cantos, captures it perhaps the best. "I have brought the great ball of crystal. Who can lift it? Can you enter the great acorn of light? But the beauty is not the madness, though my errors and wrecks lie about me, and I am not a demigod. I cannot make it cohere. If love be not in the house, there is nothing." And then finally, "It coheres all right, even if my notes do not cohere."
It takes me back to Browning. But a man's reach should exceed his grasp, else what's a heaven for?
Exactly so.
It's been a fascinating and very action-packed, fast-paced hour, just glancing on the life and writings of Ezra Pound. And Serena Pondrum has been our guide. Thank you for joining us for this hour.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us the next time around for University of the Air.